This is Norman Lear with my great sidekick, Paul Hipp.
Good to be here with you, Norman, on All of the Above.
That's the name of my podcast, All of the Above.
Yeah.
We have had guests you cannot believe.
Yeah.
Guests.
Julie Louis-Dreyfus, amazing.
Yes. And America Ferrera.
Jared Carmichael.
Yes. Oh, Amy Poehler. How did we overlook? We didn't overlook Amy Poehler. I was saving her for last. And Charles Barkley, I was saving him for first, actually, because I didn't declare up first.
I get to hang out with this guy. And this is your chance to hang out with Norman Lear a little bit here and some of these great guests.
God, I wish I was you hanging out with Norman Lear.
Yeah.
Son of a gun.
See?
That must be exciting.
It's the best. I'm telling you.
Don't miss All of the Above with Norman Lear. The first episode's available Monday, May 1st on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or PodcastOne.com.
Recorded live at Corolla One Studios with Adam Carolla and board-certified physician and addiction medicine specialist, Dr. Drew Pinsky. You're listening to The Adam and Dr. Drew Show.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but get on. Mandate, get on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for all you do, Drewski.
We've had I hear your mic on there. Yeah, nice, guys. It's been an eventful week. We've solved the riddle of Ray and your involvement with people like that. It's been eventful, quite eventful.
Got a lot done. Joshua and Ryan are coming in here and a couple of you. They did a film called Minimalism, a documentary about the important things. And I had it's on Netflix and iTunes and Amazon. I was talking to Chris Maxpat about this quite a bit before these guys were coming in. We're just talking about the doc and how we love documentaries and how this one was very important. So,
and you know, there's a kind of a movement amongst the millennials to it's a badge of honor for them to get by with as little as possible, you know, for extended periods of time.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. I mean, it's like you're it's a status. It's a status thing. If you can go to Europe and live on a dollar a day and that kind of thing.
There's an interesting thing here.
Yeah.
Is it a status thing or is it like my theory kind of applies to music, which is if you listen to a lot of the new music, you will think, and not as uptight blue-eyed devil, but just as a human being, you'll just think to yourself, what the fuck is going on? This doesn't sound like anything to me.
Right.
And it's a guy talking and there's something in the background being sampled and he's singing through some autocorrect or something. And it doesn't sound like anything.
Right.
And then you think to yourself, oh, wait a minute. This is what I would do if I couldn't sing. I couldn't play an instrument. I didn't really have ability, but I kind of wanted to be on stage. So is this minimalist thing, is it cropped up because, you know, from sort of noble origins,
out of necessity.
Or is it just a bunch of fucking losers who can't get off their mom's sofa and go, you know what? That makes me a winner because I don't own a house.
I don't know. It's a good question.
Is it
just adaptive? You know, is it just adaptive? Like, hey, if it's going to be tight, let's be good at being tight. You know what I mean?
Oh, I like the idea. There's two kinds of recycling. There's, hey, I go out and separate the cans and the bottles and from the trash and because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And then there's the exact same guy doing the exact same thing, except for he's destitute and he's picking stuff out of your garbage can. Now, it's both recycling.
Yeah, yeah.
And it both should be applauded.
Yeah.
But the origins of one are very different than the origins of the other.
The motivations are different, yeah.
The motivations.
Agreed. Well, we'll have them speak to that. I haven't talked to them. It'll be interesting to hear what their opinion is on it. I think it's dual.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's sort of a dual thing. I have a little theory too. I don't know if I ever shared this theory with you. I think that women are very attuned to their environment, and the things that they find attractive in the male very often is sort of an adaptation to a particular social or cultural or historical moment. And when I say status,
so these guys are posers or trying to get laid?
No.
No, that's what you're saying, though. What you're saying is
it motivates them. It helps motivate them to want to be.
You're saying is, you know, there was 100 guys at Occupy Wall Street who really had strong definitions about the man and then these institutions ripping off people. And then there's another 500 guys who showed up to see if they could get their dick sucked. Right?
Or at least their status in the eyes of their female peers went up if they supported it.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get it. With the, you know, there's There always the people that are down with the cause, and then the people that are trying to get laid with the cause.
It's not as clear as that, but yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, Casey.
Casey.
Hello.
Hey there.
Oh,
hey there.
Yeah. So my question's for Drew. Drew, I was wondering when people are being weaned off Suboxone.
Yeah.
What typically is the dose while they'll take them off and like would not have that much withdrawal? You know.
It does not exist. Even 1 milligram, they have withdrawal. It's a very difficult drug to get off of. Very.
That's so why. I came off about a year ago.
Is that like methadone?
Months. Yeah, it's like the new methadone. It's better. It is genuinely better, but it's the new methadone. But yes, go ahead.
I came off about a year ago for 4 months, but I didn't actually experience any withdrawal. I got really low. And I actually started again like 4 months or so afterwards, and then I'm like on one and a half milligrams now, but. I'm trying to come off again. So,
One is obviously the goal, but my experience has been even with 1 milligram going to zero, you'll get a couple weeks of withdrawal. Were you taking
one? Is the goal? Wow.
Well, ideally, but
so if, when I came off, I was making a 2 milligram pill last probably like 2 or 3 weeks when I came off, and that was but I didn't experience anything. But.
Okay, all right. So you got way down. Were you taking anything else? Yeah. You smoking pot or drinking or something?
No, I wasn't at
all. Right. I mean, if you can do that again, most people just won't do that because they start having such significant withdrawal as they go down towards one. I just say stop and let's go through it.
Yeah, I actually might do that this time because it just took way too long last time. I
mean, yeah, but like, here's the deal.
That does
you haven't done
well.
Any treatment yet. You have not done any treatment. No. Detox is the easiest part of opiate addiction. It's no problem. Treated it, thousands of opiate addicts. I never thought to myself, gee, we sure need to come up with a better way of detoxing these people because we never had any problems. Keeping them off, keeping off, as you have found, is the problem.
Why is the detox no problem?
Because it's heroin's 5 days and it's intense and you treat it and they get through it and that's it. And then they have post-acute withdrawal sometimes. So they feel discontented and desperate and moods off and sleep is off for a few months. But you can help with that too. And Suboxone doesn't do anything for that once you come off the Suboxone. It just perpetuates the same syndrome. But that isn't why people relapse. People relapse because of affect, many reasons, but they can't regulate their emotions. They don't feel good minute to minute. They feel desperate for a solution, and they know where that solution is, and they go for it.
Does CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, I've heard you talk about that. Is that something that could help in situations like this?
Casey, go to three NA meetings a day. Just go. If you start manipulating the treatment, and also go to CBT, that's fine. Use everything possible. But don't start dictating the treatment. It's a bad sign. Okay? It's a bad sign. Because your brain's disordered. Your brain has an opiate addiction. So every decision your brain makes is going to be to try to subjugate it back to the drug. Your brain wants the drug back. So every decision your brain insists upon will move you closer to relapse. It's just the way the disease is.
Yeah, Drew, tell me if this is a fair analogy.
Yeah.
When I see these commercials for Weight Watchers and they go, you know, you can still have fudge cake, I just kind of go, no, you really can't.
Yeah.
And it's still fudge cake and lasagna and it's all low-cal.
Yeah.
And I just sort of look for that and I go, you're putting yourself in the wrong mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other mindset is not you flog yourself or dragging a cross down the street.
No.
But the mindset is, I'm not going to be eating fudge cake if I want to be losing weight. Not
right.
this kind, not that kind, not any kind.
That's
I'm off fudge cake.
Yeah.
And then I go, yeah, but I could eat this fudge. You know what? It's not going to be tough because I like fudge cake. And I like lasagna. And these guys are telling me I can have fudge cake. And wrong mindset. Mindset is get to the gym. Start sweating and get to the meetings.
I don't know when we came up with this idea that you can't have discomfort or you can't experience ordinary misery. I don't know what went wrong.
This is a very serious
problem.
It's a very great point you're bringing up by saying ordinary misery.
Yeah.
As I try to explain to people all the time when they're like, oh, you know, what are you doing getting in that freezing cold pool? Or what are you doing? It's like, I'm pushing myself a little bit so I can get a little more out of myself. It's like, what is it? It's horrible. It hurts. I go, yeah, that does. But you know what? Not so much. Not me. Not get up, get out. But isn't that scary? What were you doing? You're driving that car over there? It's like, yeah, I'm trying to push myself a little bit here. Well, it looks dangerous to me. Maybe it is. I'm trying to find a little something here. The ordinary misery, you say. You know what I mean?
When Freud first arrived this country, they said, what do you intend to accomplish in this country, Dr. Freud? And he said, well, I'm going to try to help distinguish between real mental pathology, mental illness, and ordinary misery. And we've conflated it all into one thing. It's all bad. No, ordinary misery is good. Ordinary is part of life.
Well, describe ordinary misery.
Well, it's hard to do, right? Ordinary misery is tolerable. We call it sort of how do we used to phrase it? Tolerable frustration, tolerable discomfort. Mm-hmm. You know, and the way you tolerate stuff is by being around other people. It helps us. We use other people for support. We have to take care of ourselves in certain ways to be able to tolerate, you know, discomfort. We can't be overwhelmed by discomfort. And it requires, you know, mindfulness, interpersonal connectedness, a certain amount of self-care and self-soothing and pushing a little bit.
Yeah, you said the this
I do that cold shower now all the time, and I swear to God, I've always thought I had like something wrong with my body's sort of homeostatic thing, because I was always too cold when it was hot out and too hot when it was cold. I my body like wouldn't adjust.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore. Not adjust. And you get the other thing I experience every morning when I do it, because I do the cold shower now, and I'm doing it colder finally. Because I was very jealous of you in the very, very cold. First thing that always happens is I just take this gigantic deep breath. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like your body's like doing something. It's accommodating in some massive way in that moment. And that you're flooded with certain hormones and certain, you know, your blood pressure changes and your skin tone changes. Well, it's like, yeah, an exercise.
I'm thinking of you. Well, first things first, you're awake as soon as you step out of that shower.
That's the other thing. One. It affects your mood.
Number two, I'm now in the shower with you, not at the same time, but the kids put the heater on in the pool. Pool's too warm. So too warm outside. So I go in the cold shower, which is in a weird way harder than the pool, because there's a way where you're sort of inflicting it on yourself, even though you're inflicting the cold pool on yourself, but you can't quickly turn a knob and warm up the pool.
Right.
So part of it is the fact that it's self-inflicted. Yeah. The other part that's funny is it's weird, but used to turning on the shower and having it warm up. Now I just turn it on and dive in. Like there's milliseconds between the two. It still doesn't quite get you to the submerging yourself in 49 degree water, like literally holding yourself underwater, because that gets to the core, because you realize that this kind of shoots you in the back and shoots you in the chest, you can get under your arms, but it's not quite, you know, you're getting hit in the chest, you're not getting hit in the abdomen or the side or the thigh at the same time. You know, the thing about the pool is it's a full blown sort of global.
You get blown in the pool when you're there?
I couldn't even find my dick when it's on that.
No, you were looking though. I like that.
It is core. The thing that's kind of interesting is the shower is just a little bit of a self-light flogging. It's like it's sort of a light self-flogging. And it's uncomfortable, but it's more of a, like an annoying way, which is still good. It's still like I'm going to willfully put myself into this environment where I could turn it up to 90 degrees, but I'm going to leave it.
How long do you go for?
I don't go in the shower that long.
Minute? 2 minutes?
I'm
comparing myself against you every morning.
The thing about the pool is the pool does get the core down. Yeah. I mean, during the dog days of winter, even out here, but in the foothills and stuff. Here's what the goal is for me. The goal is for me is to wake up every morning, do something that makes me uncomfortable, but gets a little easier marginally every single time I do it. And then and then sort of just becomes matter of fact or nothing, and not a stressor or what have you. And the shower is more symbolic.
Yeah.
The pool is a little more profound. Down to the core.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's you want to get your whole body down. You want to step out of that thing beet red with steam pouring off your body while it's like drizzling outside and steam's coming out of your mouth. That's what that is. The shower is a symbolic thing, which is fine.
I feel it, though.
For sure. I mean, I don't mean solely symbolic, but what I mean is symbolic is every bit as important as non-symbolic.
Let's dedicate the week to ordinary misery or something, because I got a lot to say about it. And people have such panic about what comes out of their body that everything is overwhelming and shattering.
Well, you just know. Look at the news. I mean, what we call assault these days is someone's putting their arm on someone else's shoulder and pulling them back a little bit. They're calling that as assaulted, you know, whatever.
All right. While we get our guests in here, I want to bring up Cabbage. If you're wondering how to get funding for a small business, Cabbage helps small business owners get flexible funding right away. With none of the headaches of a traditional loan, you apply online from your phone or your computer. No waiting in line, no scanning of documents, no tracking down financial statements. I mean, that's really the pain in the ass of loans. Is forget the fact that you're like begging for something. You're spending time and burning energy, documents and whatnot. All right, only pay for the funds you actually use. They've supported over 100,000 businesses, over $2.9 billion in funding out there. Visit cabbage.com/Drew. That is cabbage with a K, cabbage.com/Drew. No cost to apply. As an Adam and Dr. Drew listener, when you qualify for funding, you will get a $100 Visa gift card. That is cabbage.com/Drew, cabbage.com/Drew.
All right, we have Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan. Ryan Nicodemus?
Ryan Nicodemus, you got it.
Nice. In here, Minimalism, it's a documentary about the important things. I must confess, I've not seen it, although Chris and I have been talking about it for some months now, and I intend on seeing it. But I like the concept, and like I said, the reason you guys are here is because Chris has been talking to me about it and talking about the doc.
Am I wrong about the status of being a minimalist? It's sort of like it's like a thing now for people your age?
Yeah, I think it's becoming a thing, but... Yeah. It's real, though, I think.
No, I understand. But the sense I had about it was that it had renewed enthusiasm.
We definitely didn't do it for the ladies.
Well, I've wrestled with this before because I have a collection of Paul Newman race cars, and I love it, but I do understand it's a burden simultaneously. Like, it's a source of some stress and a source of delight. But also stress and then pride. But I do wrestle with how much of this do you want to have to deal with?
You know, I don't think consumption is the problem. Like, we all need some stuff and we all find different value in different things, right? The question is, does that burden outweigh the joy or the value, the purpose you get from the thing? And it sounds to me like the answer is no. I think for many of us, though, we sort of walk around in this perpetual state of sort of compulsory consumption. Like, I have to buy this. I have to buy this. This constant pursuit of happiness. And we don't realize that maybe happiness isn't the point. And something else is the point. What's that?
What do you mean by happiness? That's the thing I find. I have no idea what they're even talking about.
Yeah. Well, I know exactly. And I think quite often we think we associate these momentary bits of pleasure with happiness.
Right. That's different.
Exactly.
Pleasure is not happiness.
No. I mean, we all know that you can eat that hot fudge sundae and you get the pleasure in the moment, but that's not going to lead to any sort of long-term contentment. And so what I found is that living in accordance with what my values are, first figuring out what the hell the values are, and then aligning my short-term actions with those values, that's what's been most important. And I think happiness can be a nice byproduct of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I figured out just a little bit ago that it was all really about satisfaction and accomplishment, that happiness or feel-good kinds of endeavors, they don't even feel good to me anymore. Like, for instance, the hot fudge sundae is sort of hard to enjoy now because I know too much. You know what I mean? Like, when I was 11 and when I was 26, I could do it. Now, as I'm eating it, I'm thinking about what it's doing to me, and I'm not enjoying it. Not even then. It's not even, well, you love the hot fudge sundae, and then later on you regret it. I'm not even enjoying it while I'm doing it.
Even if you
now.
Did or could enjoy it, Schopenhauer many years ago said, I go from desire to satisfaction and jump back to desire again. Mm. So you never end.
It's just yes, that's the other part that's a little insidious.
Every time you jack, I told you.
That's why I've spread it out to 9 times a week. So this, and I'm in love with the, and I think there's a thing that's going on, and I pose this question, and you guys can all tell me, because I feel like we've assembled a pretty good cast for this, and I'm guilty of it, and everyone else is, I think, as well. I said, when I was a kid, and I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and it'd be a Saturday during July in the summer, our big goal was to take a bus, or actually 9 buses, to get to Santa Monica to go swimming in the ocean. And we would just leave at, you know, 8 in the morning from North Hollywood, and 5 or 6 transfers later, you're dumped off in Santa Monica. And the only thing we brought with us was a towel. Like, we'd just bring a towel and a Ziffy board or something. We'd spread it out on the beach. We'd run in and out, in and out. We didn't have a bottle of water. We didn't have a canteen or a Boda bag, even though they existed back then. We didn't bring anything. We didn't have money for soda. We'd just go the entire day in the polluted ocean, running back and forth, in and out, laying in the sun, back and forth. And then at some point, when we're walking back to the bus stop, like, suck off of someone's hose a little bit. But hours. Hours. And now, I climb into the car and I go, where's my bottle? Where's my water bottle? Mm-hmm. I'm in an air-conditioned car, barely moving, but I need to suck off this bottle. And then you find yourself going, where's my coffee? Where's my bottle? Where's my water? Where's my protein water? Where's my smart water? Where's my Vita water? Where's my everything water?
Where's my phone?
Where's my phone? I used to go work construction. You'd be there at 7 a.m. You would do nothing but work, and then at 5, you'd sit down and start eating. Now it's like, where's the trail mix? Where's the nuts? Where's the stuff? Where's the hand? Drew, you do this. I do it. Everyone does it. How many times does your hand go to your mouth now versus back when I was working construction? We just go hours on end of just nothing, working, standing, talking, but there's no sipping, nibbling, grabbing, chewing. We're getting compulsive
yeah.
now.
Yeah, I think we're distracted by so many more things today. And I know that you can make the argument. I mean, you can go back to the Stoics, and they would tell you that your books were a distraction. Get rid of your books because they're in the way. They're keeping you from living life. But the truth is, we have more distractions now than ever before. And now these distractions are also being engineered for us, right? Whether it's Snapchat or Instagram or anything else. These things aren't inherently bad, but they do have a team of 1,000 or 2,000 engineers behind them. And they're trying to aggregate your eyeballs to make that extra click, spend the extra minute. They have these metrics to keep you there longer, to distract you even farther.
If you watched 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago, you see they did a whole expose. There's one guy from Silicon Valley who was willing to speak out and say that is the business they're in.
Yeah, yeah. His name's Tristan Walker.
Yeah. They're not in the business of entertainment. They're in the business of getting into your mind, tapping into it, and keeping you there with the reward system. And then I started thinking about Drew.
Yeah.
And I started thinking about me.
Yeah.
And I started realizing, A, your phone is always with you here because there's a certain sense of anxiety. You say you're a doctor, but it's really just looking at tweets all day.
Of course.
All right. Then there's me. Now, I go home and I shut my phone off, and it's off. It's powered down. It's 6 o'clock at night, and I don't turn it on until 9 o'clock the next morning. And people go, isn't that a sense of anxiety? And I go, no, having it on is a sense of anxiety. And they go, what if your dad dies? And I go, well, then he's dead. Like, well, I'll find out in the morning. I'll have a cup of coffee, and I'll find out. But, Drew, you're not wired that way. You have that sense. What is that? And what is the phone doing, and why did it wake up the sleeping
giant? Didn't wake it up. Before it was the phone. It was my beeper, and it was a phone. I'd have to be by a phone. It's part of my wiring from training way back.
But this also runs deeper than that. And yeah, it's not just a trained wiring.
Oh, absolutely. But this is nothing new for me. Same old.
Would we be happier if we weaned ourselves off of this?
Of course. Tell us about the tour. Is that what that's about?
Yeah. I mean, well, we've gone on a few tours now, and we've seen people from all different walks of life. So you mentioned the millennials earlier, and after the documentary came out, we finally started seeing more and more millennials show up. We've had a lot of high school kids and college age kids. But, I mean, we've had 93-year-old great-grandmothers show up at the events. We've had 11-year-olds bring their parents. And what we found out is that we all seem to be asking the same sort of questions. I think they manifest differently. We're asking, how do I live a more meaningful life? Or really, how do I regain control?
I'm so glad that people are interested in having a meaningful life again.
Well, I mean,
that's nice.
Yeah, but the question is, how do we get there, right?
Well, it starts by acknowledging, A, what you've already mentioned, what is happiness, and then, B, the importance of other people.
I think that's a big part of it.
If you get to that, I mean, that's a gigantic step forward.
There's
in the
a
last
little
30 years.
There's a little game, and by the way, it's Minimalism's available on Netflix, iTunes, and Amazon, and the tour, Less Is Now tour, tickets are available at the Minimalist.com. minimalistmedia.com.
Plural. Minimalists? Yes. Yeah.
There's two of us. We everything we do is blanketed in irony.
Do you do you guys ever sort of play this game in the quiet hours of the night, sometimes or on a long drive when you're alone? Do you ever think to yourself...
Have you ever seen Massapata so excited about a guest, by the way?
He's
really into this minimalist stuff.
That's great. Yeah. Well, anyone under 5'6 is literally a minimalist.
Ouch.
Do you ever think about, and here's a little game to play, picture somebody presiding over your eulogy, and exactly how are they describing you, and then what are they saying? What did you do? What are they saying you did? How are they describing the kind of person you were? And
or do you care? Or do you care that it be for instance, I think to myself, oh, I wouldn't want them going into much, but I want certain phrases to be there.
But what about the stories they would tell about you? Huh?
You're right. I should be thinking about
that. No one would be pleased with had a whole bunch of shit when he died.
Right.
That's not something you'd picture. Mm-hmm. But there are other things, and they may be different to different people, but if you could picture that person sort of presiding over the congregation and delivering the eulogy, what would you want them to say, and then what can you start doing now to make sure someone does say that?
Yeah, I've never played that game personally, but since you're asking me, I mean, really, at the end of the day, I just want people to know that I've done all I can to contribute as much as possible. I mean, I think I spent so much of my life taking. I mean, talking about distractions, I was, you know, buying a new car every couple of years. I was buying a house, then buying a bigger house, trying to go on the best vacations. And it got to a point where, you know, I was working 60, 70, sometimes 80 hours a week. And to distract myself, I started drinking a lot, doing a lot of drugs. And any drug addict will tell you, you get to a point where like that stuff isn't working anymore. Mm-hmm. And I really had to question like, okay, what is important in my life? Like it's not buying a bunch of drugs. It's not partying. It's not going out and racking up $300 bar tabs. But has always been important to me. What I did absolutely love about my old corporate job was helping folks get from that, hey, I'm about to fire you, to winning employee of the month, and like really helping them make that change in their lives. So ultimately, that's like what Josh and I have done like these last six, going on 7 years now, is kind of taking this lesson that we've learned, these stories and this message, and helping people make those major changes in their lives. I mean, we did a talk yesterday, man? It's all such a whirlwind.
A couple days ago.
We were at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. And the theater sat 500 college kids. There's almost 1,000 college kids that showed up. We had to turn many kids away. But it was just so awesome to be able to go up there and share this story where I'm sure a lot of them hope, you know, before they walked into that theater, they probably were having that that narrative playing out in their head. Like, yes, after I graduate, I'm going to have my college debt payments to pay off. But what other debt payments can I afford, you know, once I get that fancy job? And what Josh and I did is we went in there and we're like, hey, look, you know, debt is the enemy. Like, the goal when you get out of college shouldn't be, okay, what car can I buy? What house can I buy? And then I can get another promotion and get more debt payments. It's, you know, pay off that college loan, do things more deliberately. I mean, personally, I think, you know, the new American dream is living a debt-free life. But ultimately, having that effect, especially on a generation like that, that is what really drives me. So if someone, you know, is giving a eulogy of me, I hope they could say, like, you know, Ryan did his best to share his story with others to change their lives in a very meaningful way.
I feel very similar. I've been thinking about this I've thought about this for a long time. I just want on my tombstone, just he made a difference. That's it. Mm-hmm. It'll be fine. That's it. That's why I don't like all the stories and all this stuff.
I'm going to tell some stories.
All right.
but here's
you always promised you'd keep those quiet.
Here's the it's obviously it's different for different people, but if that's kind of
it isn't that different for really, because it people that's what the research is showing, and that's philosophy.
Well, I meant the eulogy. Sorry,
but it usually is involved contributing to other people in some way, making a difference for other people. It may have a different narrative, but it's really what I did for others to help them change. Right?
Yeah, and I think it's saying.
It's not completely giving is living. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
And it's not completely altruistic either. I mean, you feel great when you do it, and it's not like you're just doing it just to give. And it's not about giving everything so that you have nothing either. I mean, we're not trying to be ascetics or monks, and we're not trying to live a life of perpetual suffering. I think if you came to my house right now, you wouldn't walk in and say, "Oh my God, this guy's a minimalist." You'd probably walk in and say, "Wow, he's pretty tidy." And I don't own a whole lot of stuff, and neither does my partner, and we have a 3-year-old, and so my life at 35 is different from when I first became a minimalist at 28, and I realized that I need some stuff to augment my life and live the best life possible. But I don't know what someone would say at my funeral. I think it'd have something to do with my values, though, and whether it's contribution or you know, personal growth or what my passions were or health or the relationships in my life. But I do think those are pretty similar for everyone. They just manifest differently. We all have different people in our lives, different belief systems. And so they'll look a little bit different for each person. But I think that ultimately, if we're living a meaningful life, it gets us to the same place.
What are some basic things that people can do to get started with to start going down this road and enjoying this kind of life that's a little free of debt and freer in general? Because I I know firsthand what it is to, you know, you end up getting a lot of responsibility and you have a lot of stuff on your plate, and next thing you know, you feel like a little bit suffocated by just how much stuff in how, you know, I think it's probably why I shut my phone off when I get home, because, like, I don't want it somebody to call me and ask me to do something.
Well, that takes a lot of certain, like discipline or this. It requires the psychological musculature in a way to be able to do that, because, I mean, I know most of us, we're constantly just itching or twitching for that device. And the phantom vibrate, 75% of us feel phantom vibrate on a daily basis. And,
oh, really? Yeah. Interesting.
And so we're constantly being pacified by that thing. But if someone's looking to get started, I think the best thing to do is ask yourself a question. How might your life be better with less? And by answering that question, I think you identify what the purpose of simplifying or minimalism is. And it's not just the how-to side of things, but the why-to side of things, understanding why you want to do this. And that gives you enough leverage so that you can figure out what's the how-to side of thing. And it gets a lot easier, too. I mean, I think we all understand how to declutter our closets or whatever, but that's not really the end result. That, for me, was merely the first step. And I think you can go home, rent a dumpster, and throw all your stuff in it and be utterly miserable. And that's because the decluttering is not really the point. The point is what do I then fill my life with after I've removed these distractions from my life?
Oh, so it's interesting. So it's not, you know, just about getting rid of stuff. It's about replacing stuff with things that aren't stuff.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Feelings or actions or something other than shoes.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I went down this whole road of minimalism, like when Josh introduced it to me, he talked about how, well, and I saw him doing this for several months, like kind of simplifying his life. And, you know, he was, there were just some noticeable changes. And I asked him, I'm like, dude, what is going on with you, man? Like, you really made a lot of changes. His like mom passed away and his marriage ended both in the same month. And I remember when he was moving into his new apartment, there was like this wall mount, perfect like for a huge TV. And this was kind of something him and I would always like brag about, like, hey, check out this new TV I got.
Right.
And I remember seeing that wall mount and I was like, dude, what kind of TV are you going to get? And he's like, yeah, you know, I don't know if I'm going to get a TV. And then there were like, you know, just some other small changes. And I'm like, what is going on with you, man? Like, you seem happy. But you're definitely different. And so, you know, he introduced me to this lifestyle and I'm like that. I was like, this makes sense to me. Like if I don't have this huge, debt looming over my head with my, my home, if I don't have a new car, if I'm not buying a new car every couple of years and taking on that debt payment, maybe I won't have to work, you know, 50, 60, sometimes 80 hours a week. So, I was like, all right, dude, I want to do this thing. I want to be a minimalist, but I was like, I don't want to spend months, you know, simplifying my life. So we came up with this, this idea called a packing party. Mm-hmm. Where I packed up everything as if I were moving. So like Josh came over and literally helped me box up my clothes, my kitchenware, my towels, TVs, electronics, all of it. And I did it. I unpacked for 3 weeks, just things as I needed it. You know, my toothbrush, some clothes for work, bed and bed sheets, kitchenware, you know, tool set. And at the end of it, I had 80% of my stuff still sitting in those boxes. And I just remember like looking at all those boxes and thinking like, well, here's tens of thousands of dollars worth of stuff. And then I started thinking about my narrative that I was playing out. And it was this, man, if I work hard enough, if I work long enough, if I get enough promotions, maybe one day I'll be able to retire at like 50 years old. And then I can do what I want. I can travel. I can spend more time with my friends and family. I can focus more on my health. I can finally work on that big passion project, you know, I've been putting off for however many years. And then I was like, wait a minute. Like if I had not focused on the wrong things, I could probably, A, be closer to retirement because I would have saved tens of thousands of dollars if I wouldn't have bought all that stuff. But B, I would have had the time to do that stuff instead of filling it up with this crazy like work life that I had made for myself. So when I really thought about it, I'm like, what are my priorities? Like if you were to ask me at that point, like, hey, Ryan, what are your priorities? I would have said, you know, my health is my priority. If you're not healthy, well, then you're not going to be happy. And my relationships, if you don't have good people in your life, well, then you're not going to be a happy person. And, you know, I want to grow. I want to contribute. And at the end of the day, I looked at my lifestyle and how I was. And again, I was at the bar racking up $300 tab. And then in Ohio, you know, you go to White Castle at 3 o'clock in the morning when the bar is closed down. And I'm like, you know, not really acting on those priorities. And I kind of had this light bulb moment of like, wow, my priorities, it's not what I say they are. It's what I actually do. So, you know, going through this whole process, I guess it just really helped me change my perspective on what I was focusing on and what I was trying to bring into my life and what I was trying to give from my life as well.
I had a moment and I just really observed my daughter about 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago for Christmas. It was just the year that she made a list of 122 gifts, and her mom went and bought every single thing that was on that list. And I did what I always do, which is, you know, putz around my bathroom with a cup of coffee. I don't open my presents. I just watch everybody else. And I saw her starting to spin out. She was opening one, and she at a certain point, she'd get halfway into tearing one open and go to the next one and grab it and start tearing it open.
Oh, wow.
And then start tearing open, like, my son's stuff and grabbing other stuff.
This is like a perfect metaphor.
She reminded me of a shark that was in a frenzy, and when they're in a feeding frenzy, they'll bite each other. Like, they're gnawing on whale blubber from a dead whale, but they'll go nuts on it. They're wilding. Like, they're just going insane, you know? Wow. And I saw her spinning out. And then this just wave of dissatisfaction, like you've never seen someone in a worse mood. Like, you know, when you can kind of pick up the vibe of the bad mood. And she was crabby and mean and irritable. And I kept, I was just kind of watching. And it kept going, like, throughout the afternoon and everything. And she was in a no mood for anything. And I was like, you know, the living room looks like Willy Wonka's, rumpus room in there. It's like it's got half open packages and dolls and trains and everything. She was miserable, miserable. And I realized, and I could, it was palpable how miserable. Like, you know, if you have kids, hey, good mood, bad mood, good day, bad day. This was stoic, historic in terms of her bad mood. And I just said, I just realized, oh, she got everything, and she got it at once, and she started to spin.
But it still didn't solve.
Yeah, it didn't mean anything. She got halfway into tearing into one thing and threw it aside and grabbed the next thing, and it really screwed with her psyche, because when you're happiest, it's like you get that one bicycle or that one thing, and you treasure it and you whatever it. And I just thought, boy, what we can do to people if we just keep dumping. That's why I hate the lottery. It's like, I just think you're going to ruin people. You know, hey.
It almost always does.
My ex-father-in-law was a president of a bank, and seven people had won the lottery while he was there. And six of them had won bankrupt. There was one person, one couple, and they just kept their life as normal. And you're absolutely right. I mean, six out of the seven, they lost everything.
So think about that, and don't ever buy a lottery ticket. But by the way, don't ever buy a lottery ticket, not because you're ever going to win, but because you send a horrible message to yourself every time you purchase a lottery ticket, which is, I'm miserable, I'm not capable of doing this, and maybe God will be smiling down upon me. The film Minimalism, a documentary about the about the important things, available on Netflix, iTunes, and Amazon. And then the tour, that's 2017 Less Is Now Tour. And you can go to the minimalists.com for tickets, information, or wherever you like. And you can listen to the Minimalists podcast as well. Josh Ryan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us. It's been an absolute honor.
Oh, well done, guys.
Enlightening stuff and thought-provoking. And I am 100%. Yeah, you don't have to get up and leave. We're going to leave for you. We're leaving, too.
Stamps. Have you done that yet?
Oh, my God. Sorry. Screwed that up. Stamps.com. Ah, there. You want to talk about minimal? You don't need to go to the post office and wait in line. You go to stamps.com. Convenient, easy, reliable. Stamps.com. We use it here for all our shipping. We buy and print official U.S. postage. Any letter, any package, any class of mail. And you just do it with your own computer, your own printer. Easy peasy lemon squeezies, they like to say. They'll even send you a digital scale that automatically calculates your exact postage. So you just plug it in to your printer, or sorry, plug it in your computer, put the scale on there, put your package on there, and tell you exactly how much postage you need. That comes out of the printer. Very minimalist, but very... nice way to save a little dough so you can backpack through Europe. Right now, enjoy stamps.com. We got a special 4-week trial plus postage and the digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone, top of the homepage, type in ADS. That is stamps.com. Enter ADS. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. All right, go to adamcarolla.com if you want to find out about where we are and what we're doing. I got a documentary. It's called The 24-Hour War, and it's free on Amazon Prime if you got it. So you can watch that. Leave me a review, and I'll read them. Yes, Rob.
Go to Dr.com. Check out the family podcasts, and that's that.
All right. So until next time, Adam Kroll for Joshua and Ryan and Drew saying mahalo.